I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Michio Kaku writes in his new book, The Future of Humanity, that earthly organisms that have confronted a hostile environment have faced three fates. They learn to adapt, they die, go extinct, or they leave their environment for a new one. He says it's time for human beings to make plans to exit planet Earth because of self-inflicted threats such as war, disease, and pollution, and natural disasters like a supervolcano eruption or a large meteor crashing into the Earth. It's not going to be easy to live on another planet, but with the help of nanotechnology, biotechnology, robotics, artificial intelligence, biogerontology, Kaku says it will be possible. His book is subtitled Transforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. Michio Kaku is a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, co-founder of string field theory, and author of a number of popular science books. And he sits across from me here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be on.
Are we doomed as an earthly species?
Well, you know, the dinosaurs did not have a space program. And that's why they're not here today. They were on the Earth for 200 million years. We've been on the Earth for just 100,000 years. But we do have a space program. And as Carl Sagan pointed out to me, no one is talking about evacuating the Earth to go to Mars. We're just talking about an insurance policy, Plan B, a backup policy in case something gets out of control, like it's happened before. 75,000 years ago, a supervolcano erupted in Indonesia, wiped out almost all humans. Almost all humans were wiped out. Only a handful of us, a few hundred, maybe a few thousand, went on to repopulate the entire planet Earth. We are all descendants of a handful of humans that survived that supervolcano 75,000 years ago.
You mentioned Carl Sagan, and you said that he told you we live in a cosmic shooting gallery.
That's right. That's why we need to be a two-planet species, he said. Not that means that we're going to neglect global warming. Doesn't mean that we're going to neglect world hunger. These are political problems that we have to address on the Earth. But, he said, we should have a settlement, an outpost on Mars. Can't hurt. We have the money, the resources, because prices have been dropping dramatically. You know, many people saw the movie The Martian with Matt Damon. That movie cost $100 million. But the Indians sent a probe to Mars for $70 million.
70?
70. A Hollywood movie now about Mars costs more than actually going to Mars. So they should give an Oscar for Best Supporting Space Probe because Hollywood could actually bankroll the space program. That's how cheap things have become.
I do want to get to that, but let me talk more about species. I mean, most species have gone extinct, I'm assuming, over time.
That's right. I was shocked to actually look up the numbers. Biologists estimate that 99.9% of all species that have walked the Earth eventually go extinct. Now, we think of Mother Nature as being kind and nurturing, and, well, she could be, but she could also be indifferent and savage, and 99.9% of all life forms eventually die and go extinct. Now, we don't want to be one of that, so we want to be part of the species that do something about it because we are self-aware. We can do something. We have machines. We have instruments.
Well, let me pick up on that because I think one of the arguments that human beings have had about themselves is that we are different from other species. We have this big brain. As you said, we have tools. We have, for better or for worse, shaped the environment to fit our needs. That has been one of the arguments that we will prevail here on Earth. What's your response to that?
Well, yes, but I'm a physicist, and we know that ultimately the sun is going to destroy the Earth. We came from the sun, and we will go back into the sun in 5 billion years. And the Bible says from dust to dust, ashes to ashes. We physicists say from stardust we came, and stardust we will return. So, yeah, nature has given us a death warrant that there is an ultimate time limit. Supervolcanoes, meteorite impacts, yes, on a scale of millions of years, but on a scale of billions of years, the Earth itself is going to be destroyed. So it's inevitable. We have no choice in the matter. Of course, I'm not talking about a crash program to go to Mars and bankrupt the country. No, it'll take time. But it's inevitable that we will have to leave the Earth or die.
When? Isn't that part of the big question.
Yes. Well, in this century, we have to worry about global warming, we have to worry about nuclear proliferation, and we have to worry about the threat of biogerm warfare. These are concerns today. So I'm not saying that we should neglect them or escape them. I think we should deal with those problems because they are Earth problems. But as an escape clause, I think that it wouldn't cost that much to support a settlement on Mars.
But is it a matter of starting over? And I ask that wondering whether we would end up, we meaning us human beings, whatever form we would take in outer space or on another planet, that we would end up making the same mistakes that we have made on this Earth.
Well, humans are humans.
Yes, we are.
Sometimes people think that maybe the Internet will make a better human. No. There are criminals among us, and there are criminals on the Internet, too. And that's why we have hacking and privacy problems. So, yeah, in some sense, we're going to be importing some of our problems and then exporting them into outer space. But human nature, hey, what can you say? It's very difficult to change human nature.
Well, let's talk about the moon, which is, I guess, a planet that we have some familiarity with. How do you see, I guess, what is the role that you see the moon playing?
Well, 3 weeks ago, it was like electricity. Millions of people tuned in to the launch of the Falcon Heavy rocket. Thousands lined up the streets of Cape Canaveral to watch this historic event. Now, that was no ordinary rocket. That was a moon rocket, fully capable of putting astronauts around the moon, paid for by a private individual, Elon Musk. Now, if I would have told you 10 years ago that a billionaire would be creating his own moon rocket and giving it to the American people for free, a rocket that's reusable, people would have said, you're nuts, totally nuts. But it's happened just 3 weeks ago.
Well, and there's a Tesla, I guess, on its way, right?
That's right. The media, of course,
focuses
on the fact.
Because this is private enterprise.
Right. However, I'm a scientist. We realize that, oh, my God, NASA's not the only game in town. We're going to have a traffic jam around the moon. Two moon rockets. And Jeff Bezos, not to be outdone, the richest man on the Earth, he wants to be the third person to have a moon rocket to go to the moon. He's endowed his own Texas spaceport, not Cape Canaveral. He launches rockets from Texas. Hmm. So we have not one, two, but three possibilities for a moon rocket.
Let me play. This is a montage of SpaceX founder Elon Musk, and he's explaining the first mission to Mars. And this is at the International Astronautical Congress in Guadalajara, Mexico, in 2016. And again, this is a montage of Elon Musk, and he is talking about his vision of Mars.
I think the first journeys to Mars are going to be really very dangerous. The risk of fatality will be high. There's just no way around it. So I would not suggest having sending children, or it would be basically, are you prepared to die? Then that's okay, then you know, you're a candidate for going. Ultimately, I suspect that you'd see Mars transit times of as little as 30 days in the more distant future. So it's fairly manageable considering the trips that people used to do in the old days that routinely take sailing voyages that would be 6 months or more. In order to make it appealing and increase that portion of the Venn diagram of people who actually want to go, it's got to be really fun and exciting, and it can't feel cramped or boring. So the crew compartment or the occupant compartment is set up so that you can do zero-G games, you can float around, there'll be like movies, lecture halls, you know, cabins, a restaurant. It'll be like really fun to go. You're going to have a great time.
Really fun to go to Mars. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, people ask me whether I want to go to Mars. And I say, well, I'm a scientist. I'm a physicist. I'd rather read about some brave astronaut or test pilot who goes to Mars. And as Elon Musk himself famously said, yes, he wants to go to Mars, but not on impact.
Right.
So, yes.
He must actually live there,
yeah.
Right?
Now, remember that the moon, however, is right next door and is very familiar. And 3 days, you're on the moon. And eventually, people will have honeymoons on the moon. And so I think that tourism to the moon is a real definite possibility. People are going to get used to the fact that, yeah, you can be a tourist and go to the moon. And eventually, the hardier ones will say, well, if not the moon, then let's go on to Mars. And again, costs have dropped since the 1960s. people keep forgetting that. You know, in 1966, the NASA budget was 5% of the entire federal budget.
5%.
5%. That's intolerable. That's unsustainable. 5% of every tax dollars went to going to the moon. So it collapsed. But now prices have dropped. NASA budget is 0.5% of the federal budget. And who's footing the bill for all these rockets? Private individuals. Google entrepreneurs want to mine the asteroid belt. Elon Musk wants to go to Mars. And Amazon wants to create an Amazon system between the Earth and the moon. So you can order something from your catalog and have it delivered to the moon.
What do you think of this idea that it has to be fun? I thought that was an interesting thing that Elon Musk said, which is it can't be boring. It has to be fun because we're human beings after all.
Yes, I think there has to be several components to it. First of all, if you talk to many scientists became scientists because of science fiction, because it was fun to think about these things. For example, Edwin Hubble, the greatest astronomer of the 20th century who discovered the expanding universe theory, he read Jules Verne as a child. And he quit being a lawyer and got a PhD in astronomy and went on to discover the expanding universe. And Carl Sagan, the astronomer, he read John Carter of Mars and dreamed of chasing Dejah Thoris, the princess, on the sands of Mars. And so fun, yeah, fun helps to energize young people. As President Barack Obama said, we need a new Sputnik moment, a new Sputnik moment to galvanize young people. And the benefits are enormous. You realize that the miniaturization of transistors in the 1960s, because of the space program, created the iPhone. That's why we have iPods, the internet, all these gadgets. Many people come up to me and say, Professor, aliens must have created the iPhone because it came out of nowhere. No, it came out of the space program. A new space program will create a new generation of iPods and iPhones.
What did that Sputnik moment mean to you?
Well, it was 1957 when Sputnik went up, and it was like, well, it was like shock and electricity and a nervous breakdown. I remember Life magazine published a picture on the cover saying, Ivan can read, Johnny cannot. Meaning that we're falling behind in the space race. So it was your patriotic duty to become a physicist or a mathematician or a rocket scientist. But hey, those days are gone. Let's face it.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Michio Kaku. He's got a new book. It's called The Future of Humanity, subtitled Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. He, of course, is a well-known physicist and futurist, and he joins us on Radio Times to talk about why we need to have a plan B, a way to exit planet Earth. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with physicist and futurist Michio Kaku. He says developments in robotics and artificial intelligence and nanotechnology and biotechnology could enable us to build habitable cities on Mars and beyond. He's a professor of physics at the City University of New York. Let me play a clip from The Martian, and this is Matt Damon playing an astronaut who is stranded on Mars.
Let's do the math. Our service mission here was supposed to last 31 souls. For redundancy, they send 68 souls worth of food. That's for six people. So for just me, that's going to last 300 souls, which I figure I can stretch to 400 if I ration. So I got to figure out a way to grow 3 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist. Mars will come to fear my botany powers.
So how are botany powers going to hold up on Mars, Michio Kaku?
Well, the next step is genetically modified algae and plants that will thrive in the harsh Martian environment. The atmosphere of Mars is carbon dioxide. Plants love carbon dioxide. And what do they give off as a waste product? Oxygen. Oxygen for breathing. And so I think we're going to have farms, agricultural farms, huge farms on Mars, genetically modified plants that'll thrive in the atmosphere to set into motion the possibility of changing the atmosphere of Mars itself. Now, we are terraforming the Earth right now for the negative. That's called global warming. We're actually changing the Earth. So terraforming is a real possibility. We're doing it now.
So we know how to do this.
We know how to do it, right? So why not terraform Mars by injecting methane gas just to get things started? It's a greenhouse gas. And then solar satellites to beam solar power onto the ice caps of Mars. We forget that Mars has plenty of water. It's frozen. Mars had once great lakes, rivers, an ocean as big as the United States of America. That's how big that ocean was. And by beaming solar power onto the ice caps, we can melt the ice caps. So liquid water flows freely on the surface of Mars. This is called terraforming. It's for the future, but we physicists are already working out the details of what it would take to make Mars into a paradise.
What do you do about the human body and its and the harsh environment, whether it's the moon or even or beyond?
Well, believe it or not, there are hundreds of people who volunteered to be on that first mission to go to Mars, in spite of the fact that they're told that, yes, it's cold, below freezing. The atmospheric pressure is 1% of that of the Earth. Gravity is 1/3 that of the Earth. But, yeah, there are hardy souls who want to be part of the first generation to go to Mars. Now, Elon Musk is even more of a visionary. He imagines having each rocket carry 1,000 settlers to eventually create a city of about 1 million people on Mars. Now, that, of course, is going to take time. But unless you dream about these things, nothing ever happens. And he's a businessman. He's not doing it just for the hell of it. He wants to make a profit and also go down in the history books.
But you don't want to be there. You don't want to be part of Elon Musk's trip to another planet.
Well, the first generation, you have to be tough. You have to be mean. You have to really want to go to Mars. I'm a scientist. I'd rather look at the data coming from our space probes and coming from our robots. And then I would like to theorize about these things. And yeah, space travel is a little bit dangerous. 1% of our rockets have a tendency to blow up in outer space. So I think that, yeah, the first generation are going to be mainly Air Force pilots, people with a very, very strong physical constitution and a good background.
Well, let's talk about, and you write a lot about self-aware, self-replicating robots in the sense that they would be the ones to create these environments that would then allow human beings to live or some form of a human being, I guess, to live in outer space. What's a self-aware robot?
Well, back in the 1960s, we dreamed of having a lunar base on the moon. But people said, well, that's a lot of work. Who's going to do the heavy lifting? Who's going to build these cities? And back in the 60s, they said robots, self-replicating robots, robots that can make copies of themselves. Now, think about it for a moment. Our cells of our body replicate. That's why we grow. Mm-hmm. That's why viruses can give us a cold in just 1 week when a virus is nothing but a molecule. So NASA said, let's create robots that can make other robots. And they had this plan to create self-replicating robots that will then build cities on the moon for free. You simply put one of these robots on the moon, it creates a factory, and then later humans arrive, and there's your city, a whole city waiting for you, built by one robot who then used the soil of Mars to create a factory that uses metals and materials to create these things. Well, that was a great idea, but it never went anywhere because the whole NASA budget collapsed. But now we're beginning to take these old plans and say, well, maybe we can use them for Mars. Shoot a few robots to Mars that'll then create a city. All we do is land on the city and take advantage of all the buildings that these robots made. Now, of course, we have to make sure that these robots don't get too smart and take over. That, of course, is a concern that Elon Musk has even raised. Self-aware robots, we have to be careful. Now, robots today have the intelligence of a cockroach. They can barely walk across the room. But eventually, they'll be as smart as a mouse, and then as smart as a rat, and then a rabbit, then a cat, then a dog. But by the time they're as smart as a monkey, perhaps by the end of this century, they'll be self-aware. Monkeys know they are monkeys. They know they're not human. At that point, we may have to put a chip in their brain to shut them off if they have murderous thoughts.
Well, let me quote what you just said from your book. When self-aware robots do arrive, we must add a fail-safe chip that will shut them off if they have murderous thoughts. Which I guess deals with this question of the robot overlords who might take over our lives.
Yeah, there's a debate between two billionaires. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook says, ha, we're talking about prosperity, jobs, economic stimulus from artificial intelligence. And Elon Musk says, wait a minute, let's not be naive about this. What happens if the robots turn on us? So CNN asked me that question. I was on the Quest show. And I said, well, both are partially right. I think in the short term, Zuckerberg is right. In the coming decades, till the end of the century, robots are going to be, well, adding machines. They're going to be able to do the heavy work, the heavy lifting, the tedious work, dull, dirty, dangerous, the three Ds, dull, dirty, dangerous jobs. Robots will do that. But by the end of the century, robots may understand that they are robots. That they're not human. Robots do not know they are robots. You can't go up to a robot and talk to it about humans and robots. No, robots are adding machines. However, by the end of the century, these adding machines may be able to figure out some things that they are not human. At that point, yeah, I think we do have to worry.
Well, and it's so interesting to hear you talk about it because we're looking at self-driving cars. I mean, there are all sorts of things that are happening
right
in front of us now that could lead us to self-aware, self-replicating robots.
Right. So by the end of the century, I think there have to be fail-safe devices. And as the former head of the MIT AI laboratory once said, the probability that a robot will emerge from someone's garage today is like the probability that a hurricane will create a Boeing 747 jetliner from scratch. It's not going to happen.
I was going to say that doesn't happen, right?
It doesn't happen. However, by the end of the century, yes, hurricanes may create Boeing 747s. By the end of the century.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. I know some folks want to get in on our conversation. Michio Kaku is our guest. His new book is called The Future of Humanity. His a previous book titled The Future of the Mind. And we are talking about having a plan B, an exit strategy to leave this planet and go in search of habitable civilizations elsewhere, or perhaps even create them ourselves. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get David from Roxborough, and then I'll read a bunch of comments that we have here. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
There's several problems with colonizing Mars. The cost of getting there is a small fraction of the cost of staying there, especially staying there without having a continuous resupply from a two-year trip from Earth. If Earth goes bust, how will the people on Mars survive? Second, there are many problems with terraforming Mars. We don't know where that CO2 is going to go. Perhaps it'll just go back into the rocks and be absorbed by limestone or things like that. And there are other problems, too. Mars has a third of the gravity that the Earth does. What effect will living there for decades have on people?
Sure.
There are many problems.
Well, you know what?
Wait, David.
Hold on.
I'm not done here. And then to deal with an explosion super volcano, have a volcanic winter, we could deal with that at a tiny fraction of setting up a sustaining colony on Mars. It would only last for about 10 or 20 years. The reason humanity almost went extinct was that we were living in the Paleolithic time.
Let me take your comments, and obviously David's not buying it.
Well, first of all, everything he says is correct, but we've thought about it. We've gone through all the different alternatives, and we realize that the key word when you talk about going to Mars is self-sustaining. You realize that every postage stamp, every scissors, every paperclip on Mars has to come from the planet Earth. Everything has to be brought to them by rocket ship, which is very expensive.
Sure.
However, self-sustaining, that's the key. We want to create factories on Mars that'll melt the soil, create rocks, and we've already done this. We've actually created simulations of Martian soil, melted it, and created bricks. we can make large quantities of bricks from Martian soil, and we've done it in the laboratories on the planet Earth. Second, genetically modified plants. We are now, not in the future, now breeding genetically modified plants that can thrive in the atmosphere of Mars so that it becomes self-sustaining. Now, he's absolutely correct. If it's not self-sustaining, then they'll go kaput over time. But we're talking about creating your own food, changing the atmosphere to a degree so that we're not going to have any subsidies from the planet Earth. So again, everything he mentioned is correct. All I'm saying is that we scientists have also gone through ways to remedy these problems as well.
David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. So, Michio Kaku, are you an optimist or a pessimist? I mean, on the one hand, you're saying we can do all these things. On the other hand, you're saying not the sky is falling, but we've got serious problems here on Earth, and we better figure out how to get out of here.
That's right. Well, back in the 60s, you could say legitimately that the space program was taking food off the table of hungry children. You could really say that, yes, it's social problems pitted against the space program. But that was the 60s when the NASA budget was 5% of the federal budget. Now it is 0.5% and falling, in fact. And we have these Silicon Valley billionaires that want to finance it via their own checkbooks and also mining the asteroids. Google, not to be outdone by Amazon, not to be outdone by SpaceX, Google is backing plans to mine asteroids. This was an approved plan by NASA. It's called Asteroid Redirect, to capture an asteroid in outer space, bring it back to the moon or to the Earth. A 50-foot asteroid could yield approximately $50 billion worth of platinum-based rare earth elements that are used in the electronics industry to make it self-sustaining. So that's the key. Back in the 60s, nothing was self-sustaining. Nothing. Now the mantra is it has to pay for itself.
More pessimists here. Let me read an email from Warren. We do not need Plan B to leave Earth. We need Plan A to make sure life on Earth is sustainable. A comment from Suzanne. This is upsetting. Humans have such a bad track record of taking care of the Earth. How could we make a utopia somewhere else?
Well, first of all, no one's talking about creating a utopia on Mars. We're talking about making a settlement on Mars, an outpost, in case something bad happens to the planet Earth. And it's going to happen anyway. Private entrepreneurs are backing it, independent of what we say here on radio. Entrepreneurs are putting money on the table. They see possibilities. Look, they're businessmen. Let's face it. They're not doing it just for the health of the general public, but they're also people that were inspired by the space program when they were children. Bezos of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, has said that when he was a child, he was a Trekkie. And he dreamed of creating a civilization like Star Trek where the Earth was a park. The Earth was a garden, and all the heavy industry was put into outer space so that pollution was not on the planet Earth at all. That's Bezos' vision. Musk's vision, of course, is to be a multi-planet species. So these people, when they were children, dreamed of a better world, not messing up the world that we have today, but creating a better world.
Let's talk about aliens, which you do write about in this book, and have a description of what you think they might look like. Describe them for us.
Well, first of all, why did we become intelligent? For basically three reasons. One is we have stereo eyesight, the eyesight of a predator. Predators tend to be smarter than prey. Second, opposable thumb. It could have been a claw, a tentacle, but we have the opposable thumb. So we have hand-eye coordination. And third, language.
Yeah.
Now, let's do a simple science quiz. How many animals on the planet Earth have all three?
I guess just one, right?
That's right. Us.
That's us.
That's us. You take a look at the entire animal kingdom, all the animals that have walked the surface of the Earth, we're the only ones that have all three. Now, in outer space, of course, we could have aliens that have claws, tentacles, whatever. But the basic ingredients, hand-eye coordination, language, will probably be there. And then I get a lot of emails from people that say, ha, that's ridiculous, because I've been abducted by aliens and I've met these aliens. Now, my advice to you is the next time you're abducted by a flying saucer, steal something. Steal something. I don't care what it is, an alien paperweight, an alien paperclip, an alien knife, anything, so you have bragging rights afterwards and you can prove that you were abducted by aliens from space.
Well, let me pick up on that, because one of the things that you say about these aliens is they probably don't care that much about us. Maybe we care more about them than they do of us. How come?
Well, if you're walking in a forest and meet a squirrel or a deer, do you try to talk to them?
No.
Well, initially.
Oh, actually, sometimes, but yeah.
Yeah, initially, but eventually you give up because they don't talk back. And it's kind of boring talking to them. And if you see an anthill, do you go down to the ants and say, I bring you trinkets, I bring you beads, I give you nuclear energy, take me to your ant queen, or maybe you want to step on a few of them. So I think that if the aliens are that advanced that they can land on the White House lawn from thousands of light years in space, then we have nothing to offer them. We're not interesting to them. And for the most part, they'll leave us alone like we leave the squirrels and the deer alone in the forest.
Even though they're predators by nature as we are?
Well, we descended from predators. We have eyes to the front of our face. Animals that have eyes to the side of their face, like deer, are prey because they have to see the predators from a 360-degree angle. Well, if you're a lion or tiger, you see forward. That means you have stereo vision to judge distance to the prey. Mm. Now, it turns out that we have expressions like smart as a fox and dumb bunny. That's because foxes are predators and bunnies are prey. So predators are smarter than prey. So I think when we meet intelligent life in space, they will be descended from predators. However,
are we the dumb bunnies?
No, I think we are also the predators. But I think that they're not going to want to eat us, as in some science fiction movies, because we're not going to be made out of the same DNA. So even if they are predators, for the most part, they'll probably just leave us alone like we leave the deer and the squirrels alone.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Michio Kaku. He is a theoretical physicist. He's a futurist. He's an author as well. Teaches at the City University of New York, and he writes books. And the newest one is called The Future of Humanity, Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY to join our conversation. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with Michio Kaku about Plan B, about leaving planet Earth, about Martians, about colonizing and civilizing our own environment out in outer space. Let me play a clip from the 1951 film, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And this is a small clip.
It is no concern of ours how you run your own planet. But if you threaten to extend your violence, this Earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder. Your choice is simple. Join us and live in peace, or pursue your present course and face obliteration. We shall be waiting for your answer. The decision rests with you.
That's Klaatu, the alien from The Day the Earth Stood Still, and Michio Kaku, you quote him in your book here.
That's right. That was a movie that changed our viewpoint of the universe, because before then it was War of the Worlds. That is, the aliens are evil. They want to conquer us. We're the good guys fighting for our very existence. That movie turned it backwards, turned it around that, hey, the aliens don't want to conquer us. They're benevolent. They just don't want this virus called humanity, to infect the galaxy with our viciousness, our inhumanity, and our rapaciousness. So that movie was different because it turned the whole dynamic backwards toward us. We had to ask ourselves, who are we if we're the ones infecting the galaxy with all our savagery?
Let me get George from, looks like, Lehigh Valley to join our conversation. And, George, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm having a little problem with some of the logic. We have carbon monoxide being created, man-made carbon, carbon dioxide being created here, an extremely small amount. And somehow the plants, there's a reluctance to admit that the plants will benefit from this and sort of offset it. But at the same time, you seem to think that if we were to throw some plants on Mars, that even though the carbon dioxide level is the majority of their atmosphere, that these plants would thrive. And I don't see that happening. Also, just a very quick thing about the movie. The aliens there seem to think that the entire planet was monolithic, not that there were reasons why you had to defend yourself here.
Fair enough. George, thanks for calling into Radio Times. So questioning whether plants could live in this environment.
Well, plants love carbon dioxide. And on the Earth, of course, the excess carbon dioxide, we have to be very careful, coming from coal plants and automobiles. Computer simulations show that they could heat up the planet Earth as a consequence. Now, on Mars, we actually want to accelerate a greenhouse effect on Mars. If we raise the temperature of Mars 6 degrees, just 6 degrees, then it becomes self-sustaining. We get a runaway greenhouse effect. That is, the more methane you inject in the atmosphere, the more it heats up, the more carbon dioxide and water vapor is released from the rocks, and it's a runaway greenhouse effect. And so on Mars, we actually want to create it, while on the Earth, of course, we don't want to create it. But that's how it becomes self-sustaining. Nobody is saying that we have to import our atmosphere to flood the atmosphere of Mars. No, we make it self-sustaining by taking the atmosphere of Mars, heating it up by 6 degrees, and then more carbon dioxide, more water vapor escapes from the rocks to heat up the atmosphere again even more. That's how we make it self-sustaining. That's the key word. People forget that. People think that we're going to have to support a colony on Mars from the Earth. No, it's going to be self-sustaining.
George, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Here's an email. How do you reconcile addressing climate change when sending humans into space, which burns a lot of fuel and generates emissions? Again, another skeptic to what you're talking about.
Well, there are two things that are on the horizon that are positive. Why don't we have a solar age? Why don't we have a wind power age? People forget it's the storage, it's the battery. Everyone forgets that. I'm a physicist. I know the bottleneck is not the solar cells, it's the battery. However, battery prices are now dropping 7% per year. Elon Musk himself has ordered Tesla Motors to create a super battery that can energize the solar revolution by making it possible so that you can get energy when the sun doesn't shine and the winds don't blow. The other good thing that'll happen in the coming years is fusion power. In southern France, we have the ITER fusion reactor to the tune of $10 billion, which will create a self-sustaining fusion reaction, which will give us energy from seawater. Seawater could be the ultimate source of water. Now, of course, the joke is every 20 years, we physicists predict that in 20 years, we'll have fusion power. But this time, it could be for real. The nations of the world are putting billions of dollars into this French fusion reactor as a test to see whether we can get more energy out than we put in. So battery power will make a solar era possible, and fusion power in the long term could make it totally self-sustaining.
Your subtitle has the word immortality. What does that mean to you?
Well, why do we have to die? Well, buildup of errors in our body, genetic and DNA errors. But if I have a car, how come cars have to die? Well, the engine is where aging takes place in a car. Why? Because that has moving parts and it has combustion and carbon deposits and oxidation. Well, where is the engine of a cell? The mitochondria. So where does aging take place in your cell? The mitochondria. And if we can use genetic engineering to correct the mistakes in your cell, in principle, you don't have to die. In principle, we might be able to live forever. The Greenland shark, for example, lives to be over 400 years of age. How do we know that? Because the eyeball accumulates a layer every year. You simply count the layers like tree rings, and bingo, the Greenland shark lives more than 400 years of age. Now, to go to the stars, we may have to either put ourselves in suspended animation or simply live longer, because it takes a long time to go to the stars. And so immortality, both digital immortality and biologic immortality, is no longer out of the question.
Well, I'd love to live forever if I could be 30 forever, but I'm not sure I want to be 400, if you know what I mean.
Well, I think, and I'll stick my neck out, I think our grandkids, not for this generation, but two generations from now, I think they'll have the option of hitting 30 and stopping and staying 30 for many, many decades to come. We are now unraveling the genetics of the aging process.
Well, in fact, you mentioned digital immortality. You said today we leave a huge digital footprint. For example, just by analyzing your credit card transactions, it's possible to tell the countries you visit, the food you like to eat, the clothes you like to wear, the schools you attended. This is this residue that we leave behind us in this digital world.
That's right. When you go to the Library of the Future, you'll not just get a book about Winston Churchill, you'll talk to him. All his videotapes, his mannerisms, his speeches will be digitized, and you'll have a nice conversation with him. I wouldn't mind talking to Einstein. I'd love an opportunity to talk to Einstein. And one day, your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandkids will talk to you. Talk to you, their great ancestor, who was their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. And then, of course, is that really you, that digitized version of you? Is that really you? Well, to paraphrase Bill Clinton, it all depends on how you define you. If you are a biological entity, then, well, it's a tape recorder you're talking to.
Right.
But if that you is your digital you, that is everything known about you, plus your neural pathways, your memories, your feelings, experiences, if that's you, then, yes, you become immortal. Your soul has been digitized into information.
Let me see what Jim from Langhorne has to say. Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I understand Mars does not have a magnetic field, which on the Earth, a magnetic field protects life, both, you know, human, animal, plant life, from cosmic rays coming from outer space, the high energy rays. How would that be resolved in any colony, you know, for both the humans and the plants or whatever other, you know, food sources would be produced there?
Jim, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Well, you're absolutely right, because Mars has very weak magnetic field. The solar wind blows a lot of the atmosphere of Mars into space. That's why it lost most of its atmosphere and water vapor. So if we terraform Mars, we may have to periodically, every few centuries, every few millennia, re-terraform the planet. It's a small price to pay, but yeah, we may have to redo it every few hundred years, every few thousand years, re-terraform the atmosphere, because the atmosphere will gradually escape because of the solar wind.
Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation with Michio Kaku, author of this new book called The Future of Humanity. Let me read a quote, and this is something that I think you've probably had to explain over the years or certainly months. This is something that you said at the Geophilosophical Association of Anthropological and Cultural Studies. Quote, I have concluded that we are in a world made by rules created by an intelligence. What did you mean by that? Because some people said, oh, you believe in God.
Well, first of all, I never said that. That is fake news.
That's a fake quote?
That's a fake quote, right. You know, if you Google my name, you'll see lots of places where it's supposed to be my Facebook site or whatever, but it's not. There are quite a few impersonators out there, and it's just not me. You can Google any movie star, any celebrity, and there are all these fake quotes, all these fake sites. Basically, there's some teenager someplace who wants to say something but realize no one's going to listen to them. So they impersonate a movie star and then put words in the movie star's mouths. Now, I have a definite opinion about religion and things. For example, Galileo, I think, said it best. The purpose of science is to determine how the heavens go. The purpose of religion is to determine how to go to heaven. Meaning that science is about natural law, how the universe works. Religion is about ethics, how to go to heaven, how to be a good person. The problem is that when a scientist begins to pontificate about ethics, or when a priest begins to pontificate about natural law, that's when we get into trouble. But as long as we keep these two basic concepts separate, I think there's no problem at all.
No, go ahead.
And then Einstein was then asked the question, do you believe in God? And he said something that I believe, and that is, well, there are two kinds of God. One is the God of prayer, the personal God that smites the Philistines, answers your prayers at Christmas time, gives you that bicycle that you've always prayed for. Einstein did not believe in a personal God that gave you goodies at Christmas and things like that. He believed in the God of Spinoza, that is the God of reason, logic, that the universe is gorgeous, beautiful, rational, knowable, elegant, and it could not have been an accident. He thought himself as a child entering this library, this huge, gigantic library of unknown knowledge, and all he could do is read the first book and the first paragraph. While before him was this whole library of natural law. So that's how Einstein viewed the question of God, and that's how Galileo viewed the question of religion.
And does that fit how you view religion,
that's right.
God,
that's
science?
Right.
Let me ask you, actually, let me ask you on the air what we were talking about off the air. You said, and I admitted to the fact that I had a pretty terrible science education, embarrassingly so, I have to say. But you say it all becomes a problem in junior high school. And it's true. When you can see babies and toddlers learning about the world, they are natural scientists. Something happens in junior high. What happens?
Yes. We are all born scientists. We're born wondering where we came from, why the sun shines, why do the stars twinkle. And we keep this fascination with nature until we hit the greatest destroyer of science known to science, and that is junior high school. Because in junior high school, science is reduced to memorizing dumb facts that you're going to forget the day after the exam. And you know this material is useless. You're never going to use it again in your real life. You figured it out. Well, I think that our educational system has to stress concepts, principles, pictures, physical pictures, rather than simply memorizing dumb facts and figures that I forget. I teach astronomy, and I once got an astronomy final exam from years and years ago, and it basically says, list all the moons of Saturn and the radii of their orbits. And I said to myself, well, I don't even know the moons of Saturn. I could care less what the names of the moons of Saturn are. But that was the final exam years ago. So you can see that it was astronomical trivia. That's how we taught astronomy in the old days. Or learning the parts of a flower. I always thought it was kind of silly to have to learn all those parts when evolution is the principle behind how the flower evolved the way that it evolved. And so I think our educational system does a very good job of teaching you to graduate to the year 1950. The problem is we don't live in 1950 anymore.
We do not, and we are out of time. And Michio Kaku, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. Oh, by the way, my website is mkaku.org, mkaku.org.
And his book is The Future of Humanity. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri, with help today from Susan Greenbaum. And we close things out with the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
The only thing these phrases have in common are 5 seconds.
I hope somebody's taking all this down.
What are we saying to each other?
Seems they're trying to teach us a basic tonal vocabulary.
It's the first day of school, fellas.
Take everything from the ladies.
Five, two,
follow her
five,
pattern, two,
three, three, one.
We have a translation airlock on their audio signal. We're taking over this conversation now.
¶¶